If you have your Bibles, you can turn to Nehemiah chapter 4. Last week, we looked at the entire third chapter. We looked at the names of individuals and groups that contributed to the building of the wall, the rebuilding of the walls of Jerusalem. The truth is, chapter 3 sort of interrupted the flow of the story. The storyline is, of course, that the walls would be rebuilt. And remember, as we looked at chapter 3, the description of the work that was done was all presented to us in the past tense. That could be just because Nehemiah wrote about it after it happened, of course. But what we're going to see in here, even though that was in the past tense, we're going to see sort of an ebb and flow between work and description of the opposition that Nehemiah and his team faced. So chapter 4 actually returns to the story back where the end of chapter 2 left off. Again, chapter 3 sort of interrupted that flow. Here's what I mean by that. Nehemiah chapter 2, starting in verse 19, says this: "But when Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite servant and Geshem the Arab heard of it, they jeered at us and despised us and said, 'What is this thing that you are doing? Are you rebelling against the king?' Then I replied to them, 'The God of heaven will make us prosper, and we his servants will arise and build, but you have no portion or right or claim in Jerusalem.'" So that's how chapter 2 ends. Then we go to chapter 3, listing of all the people and the sections of the walls that they worked on. And now we go to chapter 4, which opens with this, in verse 1. "Now when Sanballat heard that we were building the wall, he was angry and greatly enraged, and he jeered at the Jews." Same guy, Sanballat, in the same action. Chapter 2, verse 19 says, "They jeered at us." Chapter 4, verse 1 says that he jeered at the Jews. So as you can see, the story literally picks up in chapter 4, right where it ended in chapter 2. This sermon, as it came together this week, became a series of lists. That wasn't on purpose, but you'll see as we go through here, there's just one list after another of things that you can take note of in this chapter. But as we go through here, you will see one more of those dynamics of leadership. We introduced that idea last week. If you remember, the first dynamic of leadership that we looked at was the relationship of the leader to God. And we've already covered what Nehemiah thought about God and how he knew the truth about God and his promises. The second was the relationship of the leader to his earthly superior or superiors, which we all have. All of us answer to someone. And we studied how Nehemiah dealt with his superior, his earthly superior, who was King Artaxerxes. The third dynamic we looked at was the relationship of the leader to those who are under him or those for whose work he or she is responsible to lead. We looked at how Nehemiah motivated and challenged the people to do the job. And then last week, we looked at the relationship of the leader to the work. And we looked at how he divided up his people and actually began the reconstruction of the walls. So today, we're going to look at the fifth of those elements of leadership, and that is dealing with opposition. Now, we're going to spend more than 1 week on this because Nehemiah details for us in several places the type of opposition that he faces. So let's go ahead. I want to read the entire chapter, chapter 4. We're not going to cover the whole chapter today, but I want you to get kind of the context of what we're looking at here. So we've just finished the description of the people who are building the walls, and we move right to chapter 4. "Now when Sanballat heard that we were building the wall, he was angry and greatly enraged, and he jeered at the Jews. And he said in the presence of his brothers and of the army of Samaria, 'What are these feeble Jews doing? Will they restore it for themselves? Will they sacrifice? Will they finish up in a day? Will they revive the stones out of the heaps of rubbish and burned ones at that? Tobiah the Ammonite was beside him, and he said, yes, what they are building, if a fox goes up on it, he will break down their stone wall. Hear, O our God, for we are despised. Turn back their taunt on their own heads and give them up to be plundered in a land where they are captives. Do not cover their guilt, and let not their sin be blotted out from your sight, for they have provoked you to anger in the presence of the builders. So we built the wall, and all the wall was joined together to half its height, for the people had a mind to work. But when Sanballat and Tobiah and the Arabs and the Ammonites and the Ashdodites heard that the repairing of the walls of Jerusalem was going forward and that the breaches were beginning to be closed, they were very angry. And they all plotted together to come and fight against Jerusalem and to cause confusion in it. And we prayed to our God and set a guard as a protection against them day and night. In Judah, it was said, the strength of those who bear the burdens is failing. There is too much rubble. By ourselves, we will not be able to rebuild the wall. And our enemies said, they will not know or see till we come among them and kill them and stop the work. At that time, the Jews who lived near them came from all directions and said to us 10 times, you must return to us. So in the lowest parts of the space between the wall, in open places, I stationed the people by their clans with their swords, their spears, and their bows. And I looked and arose and said to the nobles and to the officials and to the rest of the people, do not be afraid of them. Remember the Lord who is great and awesome, and fight for your brothers, your sons, your daughters, your wives, and your homes. When our enemies heard that it was known to us and that God had frustrated their plan, we all returned to the wall, each to his work. From that day on, half of my servants worked on construction and half held the spears, shields, bows, and coats of mail, and the leaders stood behind the whole house of Judah who were building on the wall. Those who carried burdens were loaded in such a way that each labored on the work with one hand and held his weapon with the other. And each of the builders had his sword strapped at his side while he built. The man who sounded the trumpet was beside me. And I said to the nobles and to the officials and to the rest of the people, the work is great and widely spread, and we are separated on the wall, far from one another. In the place where you hear the sound of the trumpet, rally to us there. Our God will fight for us. So we labored at the work, and half of them held the spears from the break of dawn until the stars came out. I also said to the people at that time, let every man and his servant pass the night within Jerusalem, that they may be a guard for us by night and may labor by day. So neither I, nor my brothers, nor my servants, nor the men of the guard who followed me, none of us took off our clothes. Each kept his weapon at his right hand. Okay, so we can see an increasing level of opposition as we move through the chapter. So I want to ask you, how do you tend to deal with opposition? I read a story this week that I need to share with you because it just reminds me of me. Okay, here we go. One day, a farmer who was a Quaker was having trouble with his mule. He was trying to plow his field, and the mule was being unusually stubborn. He wouldn't move. So the Quaker decided to talk to him reasonably. He said, thou knowest I am a Quaker. Thou knowest I can't curse thee. Thou knowest I can't whip thee. What thou dost not know is that I can sell thee to my neighbor down the road. He is no Quaker, and he can beat the living daylights out of thee. I don't know why that just reminded me of myself. We've all faced situations in which we feel like that Quaker, but we're aware of ways that we cannot or should not respond to that opposition. And so what we want is a permissible way to whip it. In chapters 4 and 5 and 6 of the book of Nehemiah, we'll see how he dealt successfully with six different forms of opposition. Again, we're not going to cover all six today. We're just going to look at the first one. But here's a truth, before we get into all those lists, here is a truth you need to remember. And that is that opposition is almost always caused by success and not by failure. Opposition is almost always caused by success. If you're trying to do something worthwhile and you're being opposed, it's more times than not because you're achieving something. You should be encouraged by that, actually. And we see this in the very first verse of today's passage, verse 1 of Nehemiah 4. Now when Sanballat heard that we were building the wall, he was angry and greatly enraged. The reason he was angry was that the wall was actually being rebuilt, something he probably thought would never happen. Nobody would have paid any attention to Nehemiah if he was failing in that task. So why do people oppose success? Why aren't they happy to see someone succeed? Well, I want to give you some reasons. These were proposed by the late professor Dr. Howard Voss. These are reasons people oppose success. First, some people are threatened by another person's success. You see, ours is a sinful world, and very few people are altruistic. Very few can get enthused about your success or good fortune. They are out for themselves. Therefore, if you move forward, many people see this as a zero-sum game. If you're succeeding, it thereby diminishes them. They feel threatened by it. And that's what's happening here with Nehemiah. We go back to chapter 2 again, verse 10. But when Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite servant heard this, it displeased them greatly that someone had come to seek the welfare of the people of Israel. So let's back up just for a second and tell you who these people are. First, we have Sanballat. He was called a Horonite because he was from the town or the village of Beth Horon. And that's, estimates vary, anywhere between 15 and 20 miles from Jerusalem to the northwest. And he was now governor of this city. It's a fortified city of Samaria. And that's to the north. Sanballat probably wanted to have Jerusalem under his jurisdiction, under his control. Tobiah, he was the governor of Ammon. And Ammon was across the Jordan River, east of Jerusalem. Now you have to remember that prior to the destruction of Jerusalem, you could call it back in the old days, Jerusalem was part of a very important trade route. Goods on their way to Egypt or Persia or Arabia or Asia Minor would all pass through Jerusalem. Tobiah to the east and Sanballat probably also recognized that if the city was restored, that trade would return there and thereby take it away from their provinces. So Nehemiah's opponents were threatened by success. The second reason people oppose success is they're jealous. People are jealous. Sometimes it's not because of any real threat to the person, but simply because of jealousy. And this happens in the church. It happens frequently in the church, although it's usually disguised. When someone is jealous of someone else, they'll sometimes disguise those emotions as a doctrinal disagreement or ecclesiastical disagreement. They could say you have the wrong eschatology or you associate with liberals. I mean, the reasons are varied and many. But the real cause is jealousy of someone else's success, someone else's position, someone else's activity in the church. And this is a factor in the attacks of these men on Nehemiah as well. They despised the Jews. They were jealous of any attempt to improve their prospects. That's why Nehemiah wrote there in verse 10 of chapter 2, it displeased them greatly that someone had come to seek the welfare of the people of Israel. They were jealous. The third reason that some oppose success is is because their projects have a different agenda than their own. Now, to me, of all the reasons, this is the only legitimate one, if you want to look at it that way. Though the reason sometimes for preferring your own agenda over someone else's may not be completely pure or even right. But that, to me, is a valid reason for opposing a project, is because it doesn't share your own agenda. I think most of the opposition to Christians in the world today fall into this category. For example, I don't know how long ago this started, but there was kind of a rash of people filing suit in these small towns and cities, some large ones, I guess, about nativity displays at Christmas. They wouldn't have it. They wanted to sue to have it removed. And they would try to intimidate city councils or even go to court in some cases. So why would they do that? It wasn't because that manger was a threat to them. It also wasn't because of jealousy, but rather the reason was because that opposed their secular agenda of that group. And their agenda is to drive any visible signs of religion away from, out of our lives. And so the placement of that nativity scene went contrary to their agenda, and so they opposed it. I think in our culture, which is becoming increasingly secular, we're going to need to expect this kind of opposition. We're going to need to expect it to increase. The fourth reason that some people are opposed to success is that they suspect the motivations of the people that they oppose. They don't trust their motives. This was at least one of the spoken reasons that Sanballat gave. Whether it was real or not, we don't know. It could have been just a cover-up for less than noble reasons to oppose Nehemiah. But he accused the Jews of fortifying Jerusalem to try to rebel against Persia. Again, back in chapter 2, where all of this opposition sort of started, verse 19. But when Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite servant and Geshem the Arab heard of it, they jeered at us and despised us and said, "What is this thing that you're doing? Are you rebelling against the king?" Now the Jews weren't doing that, of course. And Sanballat probably knew that. But it was very convenient and a very damaging claim to make. And I think many times, in a similar way, we as Christians can have our motives twisted by our opponents. So we should expect that. Next, opposition comes from traditionalists. And I say this with a heavy heart because I always thought myself to be a traditionalist in the most positive light that you can shine on that term. However, it also has a negative side, and that is people who prefer the way things have been done in the past and resist any effort at change. Those people can oppose a project. And that, again, is very common in the church, where religion in general has become a very comfortable thing, a thing in which much is promised and very little is required. The church promises much and asks little. And so in a church where no one's expected to witness and no one is ever expected to serve or to reach out to anybody, a program that's intended to change that attitude and unleash the power of the church in the community will be rejected by most as undesirable. That's a very serious situation in a church when it exists. J.I. Packer gives us some wisdom in this area. Here's what he says. In local churches and parachurch bodies, any leader who values order above ardor and routine above revival, and who pours cold water on visionaries as soon as they propose that something be done, risks becoming a new Sanballat or Tobiah. The loyalty of such people, whereby they think they serve God, is given to Christian institutions rather than to biblical truth. And they have no idea that in this they become Satan's tools for the snuffing out of spiritual life. Nor do they ever understand why Christians who have learned their faith and calling from the Bible find it necessary to fight them. The pride reflected in their confidence that wisdom was in them and that they have a Christian duty to uphold the status quo against Bible-based reformers makes the Sanballats and Tobias of our time into figures who are pathetic and tragic at the same time. But that does not in any way reduce our obligation to stand against them when they oppose obedience to God's truth. Nehemiah is our model here, a very relevant model for our time. I mean, that's the thing about Packer, is he is so direct. You either love him or you hate him, most likely depending on whether you agree with him or not. But I think those are very concise and very profound words about the people who oppose change just for the sake of opposing change. And that's one of the reasons some people oppose success. A final reason for that opposition, at least to spiritual work, is that it is opposed by Satan himself. Now, Dr. Voss rightly cautions against attributing all opposition in either secular or Christian work to Satan. Here's what he says. It would be easy to blame all of Nehemiah's difficulties on Satan's opposition, but that is too simplistic. Satan merely needed to exploit already existing concerns. It is easy for the people of God to blame all their woes on Satan, as often it is easy for the Western democracies to blame all their troubles on militant communism. But the truth is that Satan, like the communist, usually does not need to invent problems. He merely exploits or exacerbates existing conditions. That's true, of course. But it's also true that Satan is a powerful enemy, that he will do everything he can to destroy spiritual growth or to stop spiritual progress in places where it hasn't previously gone. Wisdom directs not that we should spend our time worrying about Satan as if there was no limit to what he can do, but it simply says that we should watch for signs of his being on the move. That is, we should watch for actions and passions and circumstances that make war against the cause or the honor of our Lord. So in light of these various reasons for opposition to our success, it's obvious that any leader is going to be opposed by others and should be prepared for it. It shouldn't come as a surprise to us, and yet it often does. So that's the fifth dynamic of leadership, that how we handle opposition. Okay, that's the introduction. So now we're going to begin to look at the forms that this opposition takes. And the study of this is going to span, again, chapters 4 through 6. We're going to see what comes to Nehemiah as opposition and how he deals with it. And I said there are six different forms that this takes, but we're only going to look at the first one today. And that first form of opposition is ridicule. Ridicule. The easiest way to oppose something you don't like is to ridicule it. And this is the first thing that Sanballat and Tobiah did. I mean, it says that they got all their associates together. They got the whole army of Samaria together. And they made fun of the Jews, which must have been a big public gathering, a big forum of some sort. Verse 2 of Nehemiah chapter 4. And he said in the presence of his brothers and of the army of Samaria, "What are these feeble Jews doing? Will they restore it for themselves? Will they sacrifice? Will they finish up in a day? Will they revive the stones out of the heaps of rubbish and burned ones at that?" Then Tobiah gets into the act. In verse 3, it says, Tobiah the Ammonite was beside him, and he said, "Yes, what they are building, if a fox goes up on it, he will break down their stone wall." So what we have here is psychological warfare, plain and simple. It is concerned with destroying the morale of the builders. The reason people use ridicule like this so often is, first, that it's easy, it is demoralizing, and it's frequently very effective. And it's effective because it strikes at hidden insecurities or weaknesses that we all have. Here's how it works. Sanballat asked 5 questions. And each of those rhetorical questions really struck at a legitimate sense of weakness that Nehemiah and his workers had. Let's go through those real quickly. First, verse 2, what are these feeble Jews doing? I mean, he got right to the point, didn't he? I mean, the truth is, the Jews were feeble. How could anybody, as weak as they were, hope to rebuild city walls? So again, it didn't create a new problem, it just exploited an already existing one and preyed upon their own insecurities. The second question, will they restore it for themselves? Verse 2. I mean, of course, how could they? The wall was between 1.5 to 2.5 miles in circumference around the city of Jerusalem. It had originally been built by people much more numerous and much more skilled. How could they even hope to reassemble those huge walls? So how will they restore it? There's a lot of truth in that question. How exactly do you plan to do that? The next question is, will they sacrifice? Again, in verse 2. Now, most commentators believe that that refers to the sacrifices of thanksgiving at the end of the project. So that saying would be, do they really expect to ever finish and be able to give a sacrifice? I don't know that that's what that means. I don't like that. There's another commentator that says it this way. He believes the question can be paraphrased as, are those fanatics going to pray the wall up? It's their only hope. You see, that taunt was an attack on the Jews' faith. Faith, which, as we'll see as we move on through the story, is not really that strong. But don't you find it difficult when someone ridicules your faith? I mean, do you really think God is going to help you? Why don't you just go home and pray about it? You don't need to be building the wall. Do you really think prayer is going to make a difference? It's difficult not to be unsettled by this kind of ridicule. Maybe you even have thoughts like that yourself sometimes. Will it matter if I pray? Does God even care? Is God even there? You see, if you're sensitive at all about the apparent absurdity of believing in an invisible God and praying to an invisible God, then the weapon of ridicule is surely going to be able to find a chink in your armor. And it could, in fact, incapacitate you. That's why it's so effective. It doesn't create a new problem, but it exploits your own insecurities, your own weaknesses. The fourth question, will they finish up in a day? Again, in verse 2. This actually means, don't they realize what an enormous task this is? And it was effective because the Jews knew exactly how enormous a task that was. The fifth question, will they revive the stones out of the heaps of rubbish and burned ones at that? Now, this was a bit of an exaggeration. The gates were what was burned, not the entirety of the walls. And there's a lot of debate about the makeup of these walls and what happens in the time of a fire. But when these stones, especially limestone, are exposed to great heat, it will oxidize them, it will cause the moisture within the stones to be burned out, and it weakens them. It decomposes the carbonates inside the stone and other stuff. I'm not a scientist. I don't want to get into all of that. You can You can read up on that. And the fire that destroyed Jerusalem was intense in its heat, the fire that Nebuchadnezzar had set to the city. But the truth is that the walls were not crumbled. They were simply tumbled. They were down, but they were not destroyed. But again, the question was effective because it reminded the Jews of the immensity of their task. Now, Tobiah's taunt, which comes next, yes, what they are building, if a fox goes up on it, he will break down their stone wall, is a little bit eerie in its truth, because they've excavated these walls. And the scientists that have done that have stated that these walls that were built during this time were not quite as strong as the ones previously. Could have been because of the fire. It could have been because of the unskilled laborers that put it together, or all of the above. So he was true to a point. They weren't as strong, but a fox, of course, couldn't knock them down. But you see, these were all effective points that the opposers were making. But the truth we can't let go of is that the reason these questions were being asked was that something important was nevertheless going forward. And these two governors believed that it was likely to succeed. The anger that they expressed revealed their fear that this project could actually happen. So how did Nehemiah deal with the attack? So your next list, we're going to see three things. We'll see one that he did not do and two that he did. So the first thing is the thing that he did not do, and that is he did not retaliate, which for most of us, at least men, that's often our first inclination, is to retaliate. So you think we're feeble? Well, here's what I think about you. And we just launch into it. But Nehemiah didn't do that. And if he had, he simply would have lowered himself to the level of his critics. And again, that's not at all what he did, which we'll see in the second thing. And that is that he prayed. And this is important, not simply because he turned to God for help, which he's done before. He has a record of doing that, but also because it means he didn't just bottle up his feelings, which, as we'll see, were anger. But rather, what he did is he poured out his soul before God. He admitted that he was hurt and angry. The first part of verse 4 says, "Hear, O our God, we are despised. Nevertheless, the work was God's. Nehemiah was able to put it into his hands and let God be the arbiter of what would happen to these people, to his opponents. He would be the one that would judge." That being said, that's exactly what Nehemiah prayed for. As we move to the last part of verse 4 and then verse 5, he says, "Turn back their taunt on their own heads and give them up to be plundered in a land where they are captives. Do not cover their guilt, and let not their sin be blotted out from your sight, for they have provoked you to anger in the presence of the builders." This is an interesting prayer, because while Nehemiah did not seek out revenge on his own, he clearly asks God to judge them now. And we struggle with these kind of prayers. How should we pray for our opposition, for our enemies? Well, I think J.I. Packer, again, can help us with this. The truth is, he says, that restraining the desire for revenge and asking God to show mercy to your enemies by converting them, while at the same time you acknowledge that he will certainly judge his enemies, and even asking him to start doing that at once, are not mutually exclusive lines of prayer. Both are expressions of God-glorifying desire. Both have the hallowing of God's name as their goal. And of necessity, we express both in major ignorance of the details of God's plan as it relates to the destiny of individuals. And again, I think he said that very well. So what is the result of Nehemiah's prayer? Well, in the text, Nehemiah doesn't tell us explicitly, but there are some things we can observe about him. First, we can see that one of the first benefits was that it diffused his anger. And the reason you have to assume that is that he didn't show anger as he moves forward. And I think that's important because very rarely does any good come from our demonstrations of anger. In addition, I think the prayer restored Nehemiah's perspective. If he was wavering at all, this restored it. Instead of being thrown off by these questions and accusations, he now recognized it for what it was. It's fear from these people that under his leadership, the Jews might actually succeed. When we face opposition, it dominates our vision. That's all we see. And at times, we need our perspective changed, refocused back onto the work that God has for us. And I think that's one of the things this prayer did. So the third thing that Nehemiah did was he went on with the work. So he didn't retaliate. He prayed, and then he went on with the work. He left the taunts of his enemies with God, so he no longer needed to concern himself with them. He got on with the task that God had given him. And the way he says that is just great. He says, so we built the wall. And all the wall was joined together to half its height, for the people had a mind to work. Now, Sanballat succeeded in rousing his supporters. That army of Samaria and all the people in that big gathering were probably cheering him on as he taunted the Jews with these questions. But he failed miserably at destroying their morale. In answer to Nehemiah's prayer, God renews the hearts of the people to work. In fact, so we built the wall is somewhat an abrupt summation to what happened, to the whole drama that came before it. That's all he says, is to end it. So we built the wall. It's what we started out to do anyway. It emphasizes that the work progresses. It says to half its height, and we'll see him continue to build up from there as we move forward in the text. It seems to be an act of willful, God-trusting defiance of these men, of this opposition. So here again, we see the combination of prayer and work. And we're going to see that many more times as we go through this story. Combinations of either prayer and work, or prayer and defense, or guarding, or all three. I'm going to ask our musicians to come to the front. I want to close with these thoughts. Occasionally, the broken world that we live in and the opposition that we might encounter, combined with our own frailty, can seem to overwhelm us. It can bring that demoralization that Sanballat and Tobiah were trying to do. We become demoralized and we lose hope. In these moments, the task that the Lord places upon us, whatever it may seem more than you can bear. The scope of the task and the amount of opposition, as we said earlier, dominates everything we see. The job is too big. This many people are against me. So what do we do? What is our response to be? Well, we're going to move a few verses past. We stopped at verse 6. That's the end of our text for today. But I want to move just a little past that to verse 14 to read you what our response should be. Verse 14 says, "And I looked and arose and said to the nobles and to the officials and to the rest of the people, do not be afraid of them. Remember the Lord who is great and awesome, and fight for your brothers, your sons, your daughters, your wives, and your homes." So our response should be the same. Our response should be to remember the Lord. Lift our eyes. Remember the Lord who is great and who is awesome. And then get back to work. today, remember that Satan always opposes a good thing, no matter what it is. So we must expect this kind of trouble. Remember the importance and the value of prayer. Remember to pray and work in that order, but do them both. So what troubles are you facing? I think today this text, this lesson teaches us the value of collective prayer to guide us to do those things that are needed in God-glorifying ways. It's a simple plan. It's simple to read. But at times, it can be difficult to do. And so we should follow the model of Nehemiah and be encouraged by what he did here. Let's pray together.